Margaret, exciting news. I am about to have a new baby nephew. And believe it or not, this will be my 13th nephew.
Amy, you're ready to give up your amateur status. You're a pro aunt at this point.
Our family has seen a lot of babies. And as soon as they start standing or walking, I send them all a whole lot of Pampers Cruisers 360.
Pampers Cruisers 360 don't have ordinary diaper tabs. Instead, they have a unique 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your newly mobile little one.
Pampers Cruisers 360 offer a gap-free fit that is up to 100% leak-proof, crucial once your baby is quite literally up and at 'em. And that gap-free fit helps prevent your baby from taking off their diaper, a habit you do not want them to get into.
You can say that again. And Pampers Cruisers 360 just got even better with a new blowout barrier. Need we even elaborate on the need for that, friends? For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand.
Download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers cash. Then redeem your Pampers cash for exclusive Pampers coupon savings and rewards.
Only redeemable via Pampers Club. Pampers cash has no cash value.
Amy, winter is upon us.
It's back. Seasons are funny like that. They're cyclical.
Yeah.
It's
here
not
they
winter.
Come again.
And now it's winter again. This interview is with Catherine May. She is the author of Wintering, The Art of Rest and Retreat During Difficult Times. And this book I still think of, it's just one of those books that just stays with you like almost nothing else I've ever read.
After this interview, I went and bought 10 copies of the book Wintering, and I gave them out as my holiday gifts last year because I just thought, this is the book that you need to read in the wintertime. And there is something about Catherine May, beyond the fact that she's smart and has lots to say, she has a very pleasing voice.
Oh, yes.
Very pleasing.
Very plummy.
Whenever I'm feeling extremely stressed, I like to put this episode on. It's just like, it's balm for my soul.
Yeah.
She's British, she's calming, and she just has a lovely view. I find that I repeat all the time an idea that she talks about, which I had truly never considered before listening to this interview for the first time, which is that we think that life points towards summer. We think that all of the year is waiting for summer to come, but that everywhere in the natural world, life points towards winter.
Ah.
That everyone spends, everyone, animals, people who live in remote places, that people, they do their canning, they get ready. Animals, like, we're just looking around. We had a really fat raccoon the other night on the deck, and I said, that's a winter raccoon. He's been getting ready because there's going to be sparse times ahead. And I find myself saying that to people and thinking about this episode all the time, that life points to winter and the idea of preparing and being ready for this very specific season. I've always been a winter person. You're not a winter person.
No.
You hate the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But I find the idea of preparing for a season of slowness and maybe a little bit of hardship. And obviously the way that most of us live now, we're not really tucking in for the winter in the same way, but it's just lovely as a concept.
And it's a metaphor because we might not all, you know, hunker down until the mountain pass opens in April. It's not that kind of hunkering down, but we all have seasons in our lives that can be wonderful things or can be really hard things that are kind of cutting us off and putting us into this place of isolation. And she really taught me in this episode that those things, they're not bad or they don't have to be bad. And being in that place isn't bad, but it is inescapable. It happens to all of us sooner or later, seasonally, and it's something to be accepted and embraced. And that, yeah, they really helped me a lot too.
Absolutely. I think this is one of my favorite episodes of the podcast that we have ever recorded.
Me too.
And I hope you enjoy it as well. Wintering with Catherine May.
Hello and welcome to Fresh Take from What Fresh Hell Laughing in the Face of Motherhood. This is Margaret.
And this is Amy. And today we're talking to Catherine May, who is the author of the new book, Wintering. Here's a little bit about Catherine. She's a writer of both fiction and nonfiction. Her journalism and essays have appeared in a range of publications, including the London Times, Good Housekeeping, and Cosmopolitan. She's a mom of an 8-year-old boy. She lives by the sea in Whitstable, England. Am I saying that right, Catherine? Is it Whitstable?
You're saying exactly right, yeah.
All right. And Catherine is also an avid lover of the outdoors, even when it's cold outside, which Margaret is fully behind.
I'm trying to be.
Catherine's new book is Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. Hello. Nice to meet you.
I want to live by the sea where you live. I've never been there, but I know I want to live exactly where you live.
I can't lie. It is very lovely, and it's been very soothing this year to have a sea to go to, you know, when everyone else has been missing their summer holidays and things like that. I'm very lucky.
Yes. It sounds like a big budget movie starring like Julia Roberts, Living by the Sea. I don't know. I want to do that.
Right, right. Having your sweater gathered around you against the cold. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely me. And actually, what's very funny is that this week there is a TV drama being filmed in Whitstable about Whitstable. And so they've kind of come and hypered up Whitstable. It's like all of the clapboard buildings along the seafront have now got these extra shutters over the doors and kind of cutesy signs. And they've replaced all our like plastic lobster creels with like woven ones, you know.
Whatever that movie is, I will watch it twice.
We will, yeah. Let us know.
I am the exact audience for whatever that is. I would prefer if it doesn't involve, you know, tragedy. I want it happy. I want a lot of kissing. I want by the sea romance.
I think it's a detective drama, actually. So, yeah, could be quite good.
Oh, love that even better.
I'll take it. I would prefer romance, but I'll take it.
So this is a parenting podcast, Catherine, and we usually talk about parenting books. And this book sort of is a parenting book, but it's really just a book for everyone. Margaret and I love this book. We've been talking about it all week and really looking forward to this interview because this book captures the moment that we are all in this pandemic so perfectly. And that was completely unexpected on your part. Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't do anything to cause the pandemic. I just want to make that really clear.
Are we clear? Has that detective out in Whitstable investigated that fully?
Yeah, no, you can't pin it on me, honestly. It was written long before any hint of the pandemic had come along, but it has. It's landed at a time that really speaks to the moment we're in, I think. And that was, I wish I could say I'd predicted that, but I really had not.
Can you give us, I find it a difficult book. I keep talking to people about this book and it's a slightly difficult book to summarize. But can you give us, just to start us off so people kind of know what we're talking about, a brief kind of summary overview of the book?
Sure. So the book's called Wintering and it's about our physical and metaphorical winters. So the times in our life when we feel like the world has pushed us out and we're kind of isolated, depressed, locked out in the cold. But it's also drawing on our actual winters, the season of winter, to think about how we can conceptualize that time, I suppose, and how we can get insights from how like other people survive the winter, the physical winters, in order to learn how to ride out those periods in our own life when we're struggling.
And why do you think that wintering is something we do? I think you make the point very eloquently that we all have periods of wintering in our lives when we're kind of cut off from the rest of the world for good reasons, a brand new baby, or terrible reasons, a death in the family. But they're sort of secret and shameful that we perceive wintering as something we have to do alone. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think we don't really talk about it. It seems to me that we all endure our own winters as if they're this special thing that's happened to us and we've uniquely failed and we feel really embarrassed and ashamed about it. And we don't really have a language for talking about them and for really seeing the similarities between those different moments. Because actually, I mean, the two examples that you bring up are perfect. It's really hard to talk about how having a new baby and having a death of a loved one could put you in a similar state of mind, but we actually know that they do, don't they? I certainly felt that when I was trying to deal with a tiny baby at home on my own.
Yes, it's like time out of time and nobody else is awake with you at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. And you can feel everything drifting away from you, I think.
Yeah. It's that isolation.
That's it. And that the sense is the world is moving on without you, which can be a welcome or terrifying feeling that everybody else is doing something that you can't participate in right now.
Definitely.
One thing that really spoke to me about this book, we have a Facebook group and people share a lot of things. And someone was asking this morning about sort of advice on how to talk to somebody who had had a pregnancy loss. And she said, I know all the things not to say, so don't tell me those things. I want to know what was helpful to hear. And one of the things that really spoke to me about this book was this metaphor of winter seems so useful for a time of mourning. There's a larger picture of times of isolation, but it really spoke to me as it's a season and it's a time that you are in a very specific state. And that state is, you're kind of wintering alone, and yet we've all done it. The metaphor was very, very meaningful to me, and I think would be meaningful in terms of sharing that experience with people of like, this is winter. This is what it is. Yeah. And there's an acceptance in that winter metaphor, but there's also a sense that it's a season, that it will, that there is, that spring is out there somewhere, no matter how far off.
Yeah, and that seasonal idea is helpful for two ways. I mean, like on one hand, it's going to end, and there is a kind of narrative arc to it. It does finish. In terms of grief, I mean, we know that you carry on grieving forever, but that real white heat of grief passes and real life comes back in again, although you emerge changed and, you know, like never forgetting. But also, you can't rush a season. It will take its own good time. And I think that another kind of peculiarity of our modern life is that we think we can hurry everything up if we get it right. Like there's a technique that maybe we haven't found yet, but maybe there's a book or a podcast that will give us that technique. And then we
probably can, our podcast.
Yeah, it would be. If it was going to be there, it would be your
if
one.
If it existed, it would be us. But I get your point that maybe it doesn't.
It doesn't. And I mean, grief is maybe such a universal experience that we can all recognize this, that you can't hurry grief. There's nothing you can do to mitigate it. It's going to keep coming at you for a long, long time with loads of different angles on that feeling, that awful feeling of missing someone and someone being absent from your life. And actually, the only way to deal with it is to ride it, to walk alongside it, to be part of it and not to try and defer it somehow, I think.
And I think going back to the person's question is that I have found through walking with other people in their loss and experiencing my own losses, that acknowledgement of winter is the key, I think, to connecting with people in grief.
Fellow feeling.
Yes. Rather than saying, you know, it'll all be okay. Things happen for a reason. God must have wanted another angel. These things that we hear that people are like, please don't say these things. That the problem with those things is that it's not. It's that to the people who helped me the most in times of my own wintering were people who looked at me and said, you're in winter and that's hard. And that, it moves me just to say that out loud. You know, there's something very powerful in acknowledging, and that's what I think is so powerful about the book overall, just acknowledging that winter is such a huge part of it that I think a lot of us try to skip.
Yeah.
Because we want to go right to like, you'll be okay, it'll be fine. And not every situation will be fine. And as you said, some griefs are with us and have changed us for the rest of our life. And people who have an ability to acknowledge that to you, I found very useful to me.
I think it's really important. And I think we are only just beginning to get back to the point in our society when we can look at grief again and see it for what it is, which is an awful, painful loss, you know, and there's no bright side to that. Like, we can't, you know, draw the sunny side out of grief or, you know, draw lessons from it too soon. It's part of our humanity. It's fundamental to us. And in a lot of ways, it's very beautiful. It's very pure. But whenever I, you know, hear somebody, particularly with the loss of children, I mean, sort of saying, oh, well, I suppose that means that, you know, X, Y or Z. No, there's not a bright side to this. The really empathetic and sympathetic response is to say, wow, this is horrible for you. Let me be with you while you're feeling horrible.
Catherine, can we talk about the events that sort of inspired you to write this book, because they are not grief, or at least their grief of a sort. Can you talk a little bit more about your own wintering?
Yeah. So this time around, because I, you know, one of the points I make in the book is that we winter in cycles and it comes at us again and again. But this particular time, I was just about to celebrate my 40th birthday when my husband fell very suddenly ill with a really nasty appendicitis that left him in hospital for quite a while we were, you know, really worried about him. And as he was recovering, I realized that I'd been unwell for quite some time. I'd had a lot of abdominal pain and it suddenly took over. And at the same time as that, I was in the process of leaving my job because I already knew that I was very stressed and I had to get out. But that time for me collided when I became so ill so quickly that I had to be signed off work for several months. And that those months I was serving out my notice that I'd given on my job. And that was incredibly hard for me because I felt really isolated from my colleagues. I felt like I'd let them down when I should have been gradually handing over my role. I felt paranoid. I felt humiliated. I assumed that everybody was talking behind my back. And I was also really worried. My doctor told me to brace myself for a cancer diagnosis. And it turned out not to be, but actually I had pretty much destroyed a lot of my bowel by living for many, many years with severe stress. And so once I'd got on top of that as much as you ever can, shortly after we had to take my son out of school because he had just stopped coping altogether. And we realized that our family life had got to the point where we were just firefighting every night and every morning to get him to and from school. And I had to just push the stop button and say, right, this all ends. We can't keep throwing ourselves at the world like this. We've got to take some time out. And so that's what we did.
There's so much in that that we want to discuss. We'll be right back after this break. Amy, on this podcast, we try to always offer useful takeaways. And if you learn nothing else from us, learn this useful parenting lesson by Pampers Cruisers 360.
Pampers Cruisers 360 are the ultimate parent hack, the best diaper to use as soon as your baby starts standing or walking. Instead of ordinary diaper tabs, they have a unique 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your wild child.
Pampers Cruisers 360 makes it so easy to change your baby. Who probably doesn't stop moving just because they need a diaper changed? Just slide on to apply and away they go.
And fear not, parents. Pampers Cruisers 360 offers an up to 100% leak-free fit. And they just got even better with a new blowout barrier. Need we say more?
For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand. Download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers cash. Then redeem your Pampers cash for exclusive Pampers coupons, savings, and rewards.
Only redeemable via Pampers Club. Pampers cash has no cash value. More and more, you hear about the importance of electrolytes as part of staying hydrated, because you need the sodium and the potassium, not just the water. And whether you're looking to hydrate during a workout, while traveling, or at the end of a long night, Sports Research Hydrate Electrolytes have got you covered with over 65 trace minerals, 7 essential vitamins, and coconut water powder.
Crisp and refreshing and without any sugar, this is hydration powered by Sports Research. They're little packets you can just grab and take with you to mix into your water bottle on the go. My favorite flavor so far, Amy, gotta be the cherry pomegranate.
Interesting. My high schooler likes the lemon lime, and she keeps a few handy in her backpack for days that she has practiced after school. These electrolytes have the sodium and the potassium that you need to go with it in the optimal ratio for daily hydration.
Visit sportsresearch.com and use code WHATFRESH at checkout for 50% off your purchase of Hydrate.
That's Sports Research, SportsResearch, sportsresearch.com, and use code WHATFRESH for 50% off your Hydrate electrolytes order.
Okay, we're back. And Catherine, one of the things that really struck me in those stories, and again, it's not a parenting book necessarily, but there are so many parallels for parents. And this feeling of letting other people down when we're struggling is something that comes up again and again and again for us as hosts of this podcast, and our listeners express it. And it's something that I think, again, I haven't really heard discussed in this way of the
part of the problem of winter coming is that it puts all this stress on us that, like, no, our job is to be out there doing all of the things. And if we're snowed in, it's not just that we need to deal with our own problems. It's that we're not taking care of everyone else. You'd speak about it specifically at work. And but I thought that was a really interesting thing that I've heard come up for our listeners a lot.
Yeah, I think it's something that comes up with women a lot and mothers a lot. You know, we feel like we should be taking care of everybody. We feel like we should be on top of things. And quite often, I mean, when you talk to women who have really crashed, you listen to them and they will tell you that they were not only taking care of their family and, you know, their nearest and dearest, but they were often also like getting involved in other people's lives as well. You know, they weren't kind of dropping round with meals for the person that was struggling down the road who they barely knew, or they were looking after other people's kids after school, or they were volunteering to take over, you know, the local Girl Guide troop because nobody else would do it. And so they felt like they had to step forward. And I think that, you know, women often feel this huge sense of responsibility for everything and end up really, really crashing, actually.
And how did that play out for you in terms of this series of events where your husband became ill, you became ill, your son had issues at school? How do you extract yourself from that in a healthy way?
Oh, well, I'm not sure there is a great way to do it. I mean, I had to just keep looking after everybody, but I also had to find time for myself, and I had to acknowledge that I was suffering too, and that actually I was, you know, really affecting my own physical health and certainly my mental health. And that meant using the time that this wintering opened up for me just to do some very simple things that were about making space for me to reflect, really, and to tick through all the stuff that was happening until I could process it. So I did things like I baked a load. You know, I baked hilariously bad bagels that kept unraveling themselves.
I love that story.
I used to be a really good baker, but I've lost my touch. I took loads of walks. I learnt to swim in the cold sea in winter. I just took the small bits of space that I could. You know, I never get big swathes of time anymore. I used to love going away on retreat before I had my son. I used to book myself a little hut in the woods and spend a few days there on my own. And that's just not possible for me anymore. But I can actively find time to rest and to just be myself for a while and to find solitude. Solitude's really important to me, I think. I don't know if everyone shares that. I think other people get renewed by spending time with other people, but I need that time on my own. And if I don't acknowledge that need, then I'm not doing anyone any favors because, frankly, I'm grumpy and horrible to be with, but I'm also just tired and out of ideas.
You said something in the book about a tree, and I went for a walk this weekend and looked at a tree, was blown away that I had never realized this, that you look at a tree and it seems dead. It appears dead. And Margaret will tell you, I am the dreader of winter on this podcast. I'm like, just going to hold on and wait for spring, and it can't come soon enough. But that a tree is, in fact, not dead. It's the buds of its next leaves are present. They're there. The tree just knows that this is not a good time to expend that energy. So it's going to hold the leaf buds until there's enough sunshine for them to succeed. And I had never looked at a tree that way. And I had never looked at winter that way, that when the world feels overwhelming, it's time to stop forcing the new leaf buds. It's time to stop and hold and wait for better conditions, so to speak. I'd never thought of it that way.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a huge learning for me, was knowing that these little buds are on the trees right now and they look really bare. I'd never noticed that before. Isn't it funny that you can live a whole adult life and not know something as simple as that? But actually, when you begin to look at the biology of this, all of nature is not pointed towards summer. It's pointed towards winter. It's pointed towards that point of survival at the darkest point of the year. So the trees, they dispose of their leaves when they're not needed anymore so that they can draw in their energies and make sure they're ready for the next year when they come back bigger and better, actually. And I mean, I spent some time with hibernating dormice, which was the cutest 10 minutes of my life, holding a sleeping dormouse. But, you know, they are awake for a tiny fragment of the year compared to how long they sleep. And they spend the whole time they're awake getting fat, ready to survive that long sleep again. And they're squishy. By the time, you know, these little kind of dumpling dormice that you can hardly see their little hands because it's absorbed in all of their squishy brown fat that they've laid on. And it made me really realise something, which is that we can't only live for the good times and we can't only make those count. You know, they are not all of human life. And I think we often think that anything that isn't completely joyful and completely perfect is something we've got wrong. But actually, the winter is normal for us. It's part of being human. And if we only count the other times, then we are just pretending. We're like wishing away such a lot of our life. There are certain pleasures to winter, I think, and to personal winters as well as physical ones. I mean, I love the cold. I guess I should declare that.
I'm a winter lover as well, but Amy's a harder sell. But I think that idea of life points to winter is, again, it's so useful for myself personally and parents writ large, which is, I think that this misperception that it is our job to be the joy cruise director for everyone in our lives and to make sure that every day is a, you know, party on the Lido deck and you're doing the limbo. And if you're not, then I have somehow personally failed my duty as the happiness cruise director for the 400 people I know. And like, you're going to get your card and it's so, it's a pandemic, but I'm still going to make sure we have the elf on the shelf and, you know, whatever the, and some people take joy in those things. And there are moments of that. My house is festooned like Mad Woman with Christmas stuff because I wanted to cheer myself up.
But that is what Christmas is, right? I mean, every year we put up the lights, we put up the decorations to sort of keep the darkness at bay.
But I think that reorienting this idea for ourselves and our children, that we had a very terrible tragedy that happened in our town that affected my kids. And counselors came to speak to us. And one of the counselors said to me, and I've discussed it before because it made such an impression on me. She's like, you would never in a million years wish for something like this for your children. But at the same time, the lesson they will take from this, something so terrible happening when they were very young, it will expand their understanding and make room for more of life for them. That idea really moved me. And I think the same thing in this book, which is that holding grief and badness and tragedy at bay, you're missing out. We always say, like, don't do it because someone wrote it in a book. Do it because it actually helps you. And I think allowing ourselves and allowing our children to sit in that winter and that grief and say, this is a time where you are in pain, but it's making you stronger. In the same way that when you're exercising, you're in pain, but it's making you stronger. Like, it's an exercise in a way that is giving you something. You would never have wished for it, but don't miss the gift of it. And that's something I think about a lot in reaction to my kids, because I think I have an instinct to be the cruise director.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to leave more room for, like, yes, this does feel bad because you made a really bad choice and now you're sitting in some pretty gross consequences from that bad choice. And it does feel bad. And allowing more room for winter for myself and my kids is something that I need to work on.
I think that's so wise. And I know that I think about exactly the same issues so often too. And actually, like, we talk a lot about making our kids resilient, don't we? We know that we ought to want our kids to be resilient.
Yes. Grit is what everyone's obsessed with. We've got to have gritty kids.
Yeah. But for that, for our kids to really become resilient, they need to be able to deal with darkness. And if we only ever show them happiness, if you, as you say, the kind of cruise director, like, if they're only ever being jollied along and encouraged towards joy and happiness and, like, essentially looking happy so that we feel better about our parenting quite often.
Yeah, that's great. Exactly.
Like, they cannot develop resilience that way. It's just not possible, because the first time they leave our circle of influence and something bad happens to them, they're going to fall to pieces. And I talked to my son a lot about this when I took him out of school. He was only six, so he was very small. But I talked to him a lot about how he's suffering right now, and we're going to work through this together, and we're going to be sad together. But that actually he's learning such a lot. And one of the things I kept hammering home to him was that he's learning a lot so that he could show compassion to other people in the future too, and that he could really help others. And I think that's a beautiful thing to be able to offer the world, actually.
Can we talk a little bit more about that? I'm curious how you and how any parent sort of protects their little ones right now. I mean, a lot of us are going through a lot of grief or worry or, you know, all kinds of things. And it doesn't really help that we're having this universal experience because we're all hibernating in our homes and doing it.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of letting my kids in to this is a difficult period. We're going through it together. And I try to do that in some ways. And my kids are older. My kids are teenagers. But how do you know sort of how much to let your kids into the process and how much to go with what I think sometimes is our natural instinct, which is to be like, winter isn't happening, not in here.
Yeah. And that is a really, I found that balance very hard to come by, because actually my first instinct was to say, right, we're going to watch the children's news together every day. And like, we're going to make sure we're being really mindful about what's happening here, but in a kind of measured way. But I quickly realized that that was not helping him at all. He needed to be able to shut off from all the bad news that was happening, because there was a level of insight that he kind of couldn't get. And quite early on, an ambulance came past our house and he said, "Is that a COVID wagon?" And I was like, "What? Where did you even get that? Like, what is that? Is that something people have been saying at school?" But I think in his head, you know, this, he couldn't quantify what it would mean to have a pandemic. And I think he was thinking that there would be, you know, like people being shipped away all the time. And that made me really think that, you know, we have to protect kids from that 360 degrees news that we all suffer from too. And so I've been kind of drip feeding him information, but we still mention it every day. But I've reduced his exposure as much as I possibly can, because he doesn't need to deal with all the fears that we're dealing with.
And I think that's right, because it's developmentally appropriate age-wise. And we talk a lot about that. What is developmentally, what can kids handle, basically? Mm. And in that our job as parents is to kind of be our kids' guide and companion through life. We are protecting them from many things. You know, we're protecting them from eating strange, you know, berries off the bush so they don't get poisoned.
Hopefully.
Yes. And we're protecting them. I don't think we have to suddenly be like, welcome to winter, gritty kids. Here's the whole lot of it. Like, it's okay to say we're going to let in as things, you know, we just had a family member who passed away, and we decided at what point to mention they were sick. We decided at what point to kind of give them the outcome possibilities. You know, we very much guided the experience because we didn't want to suddenly drop cold water on their head that they weren't ready for. But so it's like you can control, I think you said, well, the drip of information, right? The drip feeding, like, and that's what they're up for. And so it's not that we're holding things away from them, but we're drip feeding them.
I do think we're like in Brave New World, though, for our generation of parents, because actually I think we're more conscious of the psychology of childhood than any generation has ever been before. I think we have learned lessons from maybe our parents' generation who often didn't tell us anything. You know, I know that when my grandmother died, like, my family's instinct was like, it was none of my business almost. And that,
let's not discuss it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that they thought they could protect me by not telling me any of the details. And so the shock was enormous, because I had like literally no notion that she could die at that point. And on the other hand, like, we also value childhood as a concept. Like, we want our kids not to have to be forced to grow up too quickly. And I think we're all treading such a tricky balance. And then this lands, like, just as we're all asking those questions anyway, this damn pandemic lands and we're supposed to figure it out. I don't think anyone knows. And I also don't think that we are getting the balance right for the amount of news we're taking in. So how on earth are we supposed to manage it for our kids?
All right, we're going to talk more about that after we come back from this break.
Margaret, I've been at the research again, looking into metabolic health and, more importantly, metabolic flexibility, which turns out is the key to improved energy levels, better sleep, better fitness, all the things. And I found out about all this because we got a chance to try Lumen, the first handheld device that helps you manage your metabolic health.
Lumen works when you breathe into it. If you do that first thing in the morning or after a workout, Lumen measures your metabolism by measuring the amount of carbon dioxide in your breath. It's science, people. That lets you see exactly what's going on in your body in real time.
Then you use Lumen's app to get tailored guidance to improve your sleep, your nutrition, even stress management. If you're interested in figuring out the effects of different sorts of foods on your body, Lumen is a really cool way to see what's actually happening as your body burns different fuel sources.
If you want to take the next step in improving your health, go to lumen.me and use Fresh to get $100 off your Lumen.
That is lumen.me. Lumen.me and use the code Fresh at checkout for $100 off.
Thank you, Lumen, for sponsoring this episode.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.
So, Catherine, let's talk a little bit more about what you learned in your research for this book about what nature can teach us about slowing down.
Oh, goodness. I learned so many wonderful things. I wanted to see what the animal kingdom did. So I thought a lot about hibernation and wondered about whether we as humans hibernate. And it came to me that actually our sleep pattern naturally changes in the winter. So there's some really interesting research, like both historically and there's some kind of contemporary science that's been done by putting people through what a pre-industrial revolution winter would look like with no artificial light and no clocks. And I discovered that actually, instead of hibernating, human beings have a really interesting pattern of sleep during the winter, which is that they wake up in the middle of the night. And that we tend to now read that as insomnia and see it as a really terrible thing. And again, we think we've failed because we think it's a medical condition and like our sleep's gone wrong. But actually, if you look back into history, there's evidence that people massively valued waking up in the middle of the night in winter. So they saw it as a time when they had like special quiet family time between maybe them and their partner or them and their kids. And it was also this very meditative time when they wouldn't be able to do much because there wasn't much light available, but they would perhaps be meditating, praying, having conversations with each other, having sex, all of the kind of lovely, quiet, intimate things that you might do with your time. And I, you know, began to think about whether this is what our hibernating looks like a little bit. We're going to bed early, we're getting up late, but we're also finding this pocket of time in the middle of the night that's actually very special and very particular to winter. So that was maybe one like natural thing that I looked at. I also thought about how nature winters, like how it like brings about efficiencies for winter, how it strips itself down to the barest bones and then flourishes again in the spring. And there's a rhythm to that that maybe we've forgotten, that we too can draw ourselves in sometimes and then bounce back into the world when we're good and ready and when the time's right, rather than keep forcing ourselves through loads of social interaction when actually that's too much for us in the darkest seasons.
And you also talk about cultural winter, so how certain cultures handle winter and prepare for winter. Again, this idea of preparation. And what are the parallels for people thinking about this new conception of winter?
Yeah, so I set out to find out what it was like if you were intimate with deep winter. So people that got snowed in every year. I mean, that's something that I've never had to deal with. Like, we don't get very much snow in Whitstable. So I looked at Scandinavian cultures and talked to people who, you know, would expect from, say, November to February to have their lives seriously curtailed every year because the temperature is way below zero and there's deep snow everywhere. They can't get around. And, you know, again, I learned that they prepare all through summer, just like the animal kingdom does. They preserve food, so they've got delicious stuff to eat. They make sure that their home's repaired. They make sure that everything's ready for the winter. And they make special time during that winter period when they're locked in. So they don't try and pretend it's not happening. And they don't think that it's a great thing. You know, we talk about how much Scandinavians love the snow and how they are, you know, really great with their hygge culture. Well, the truth behind that is that they do it because they absolutely have to, because they know there's so much darkness if they don't find a way to cope with it. You know, they know their alcoholism rates are high. They know their suicide rates high. They know that every year people go out in the cold and die from exposure if they get it wrong. So they create this cozy environment as a way to keep themselves sane and safe throughout winter. And that led me to an exploration of the sauna in Finnish culture, which I found fascinating.
It's another funny story, the sauna.
Oh, yeah. Well, my own exploration didn't go so well. I mean, it, you know, the person I spoke to about it made it sound great. And she, you know, she sort of said that in Finland, you would not be without access to a sauna. Like, every family's got one. And if you haven't got one yourself, you're sharing it between a few families. And everything happens there. All of life happens in the sauna. And you get together with your family and you talk. And then you have a beer afterwards. And it's really soothing. So I thought I might try and go and sauna. And I fainted on the floor.
So that wasn't the right solution for you.
I'm not good at heat. I am genuinely a chilly mortal. But yeah, I had a very undignified moment of the whole sports centre arriving en masse to give me first aid while I was in my knickers on the floor. It was awful.
And so sauna wasn't it for you, but draw us out of the metaphor of winter here, how other people do it, how they prepare. What is the practical application for people who are saying, okay, winter, the season, but also in personal winters, how do we prepare? What is the metaphor of the sauna? What might that be for people in their own personal winters?
Well, I think there's a few metaphors that it leads to. I mean, I think it's about contact with the cold. And what I mean by that is contact with your actual feelings, like being there, actually mindfully addressing what's going on in your head rather than constantly escaping it. I mean, that's what seems to happen in the sauna in those cultures, is that people talk through their problems. It's like therapy. And, you know, therapy is a great idea, incidentally, during winter. But it's also about really feeling the bite. And, you know, so I didn't like the sauna, so I started cold water swimming. And that was the thing that really did it for me, that really helped me to cope. Because actually, when I took my body into that incredibly cold environment, my mind was absolutely in the moment. I stopped escaping and imagining this kind of past and future that, you know, could only go wrong. Like, I stopped that paranoia and I took myself right into the basic moment of survival. And for me, I found that incredibly compelling. And I think that's really instructive. Not everybody wants to get into the freezing cold sea like I do. I get that.
My sister does. She's a lunatic, though, so I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, I think a little bit of madness is a good thing to have sometimes. I've been swimming today. But what it taught me is that you need a way to shift your mind into your living at the moment. Like, stop worrying about the future. It's so hard to do. But if you can be exactly where you are at the time, you've got half a chance of processing what's going on. But our tendency is to keep worrying about what we did in the past and to keep trying to reimagine the future and to see if we can make it work for us. And we have got no control over either of those things. What we have got control is what we do in the here and now. And we need to get on with the raw experience of living as we are. That's all we can do. That's all we can control.
I realized reading this book that that's what I have been doing with winter, not even dreading the future. I've been like please come future, right? Like, all I have to do is just try to sleep until April 1st and then this is going to be okay. But just to be in the isness of the moment of this is where I am and this isn't something to be withstood. This isn't something to be gotten through as quickly as possible. This is a useful cyclical part of my human experience. I haven't really thought of it that way before.
Yeah, it's really hard to do. But I think actually, you know, when you've got kids, you almost don't have a choice, do you? Because you have to be managing their response and how they're dealing with it. And you have to be finding a way through. Like, that's our job as parents. And so that does take us into the moment. But if we teach our kids to only be deferring it, like, to, you know, my son would sit on Minecraft all day, every day if he could.
Yes.
And I have to drag him away from that sometimes because he needs to know where he is in time and space. Like, this isn't the best time of our life, but it is a time. And it is really important for him to grow and learn through this rather than to numb himself, because numbing yourself in the end doesn't work, unfortunately.
You say that there's wisdom to be gotten from wintering and that people who have wintered have great wisdom. What do you think the wisdom is that you've gained from your own winters?
Oh, I wish I knew. I wish I could just hand you down something that was really...
Can you save me the trouble? Can I skip to April?
Sorry, it's not that simple. But I mean, I think the wisdom that I've learned is to regulate myself through those times, actually. That doesn't sound like a very big thing, but I've got the measure of the shape of those times when everything goes wrong now. And I trust them much more than I used to. Like, I don't think my life's ending. I don't think that I've failed now once and for all and it's never come back again. I instead think I'm in a winter. And that sounds really small, but it's massive. Like, having that situational awareness that you're going through something at that moment rather than the whole world's coming in is such a different experience. And that's, yeah, I think that's my wisdom that I've gained.
What about people who feel like life is a winter, you know, that they don't find it cyclical, they don't find it seasonal?
Yeah, and I actually think in terms of, say, chronic illness.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, I was thinking of someone specific, and that's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I think we often, you know, when we talk about seeing the positive side, they're exactly the people we leave out of this conversation because we're looking for that win at the end of winter, you know, and like it's all going to be.
The good part.
It's got to be crocuses or it wasn't worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of what we're processing in winter is unwanted change and negative change. You know, like, not all change is positive. There's not a bright side to everything. But I do think that what we're looking for is the way forward, the way to live. And so, I mean, like, to give an example from my own life, I was 40 or no, a little bit before 40 when I learned that I was autistic after living a whole life thinking that I was just like a wonky human being who didn't cope with anything very well. And that was really difficult change to process because that was a moment when I had to accept that I wasn't going to find the right therapy or the right self-help book or the right physical therapy that was going to make me cope with life like the people around me did. But by processing that unwanted change, I do live a much better life. Like, I live with more restrictions than I used to, but that's because I've stopped throwing myself at, you know, all the things that I can't do that completely exhausted me, like some demented blue bottle against a window pane. And so, you know, that's the change that was being offered to me. I don't get to say, no, sorry, I'm not, because I am autistic. But it has let me make a load of adaptations that I'd never have thought to make before, which at first felt like restrictions, but now which feel actually really liberating. And I have the same with my, you know, with all of my various gut problems. Like, I can't eat the stuff I used to eat. I can't mess about with my stress levels as much as I used to. I have long periods when I feel unwell now, when my movement's restricted because everything's so painful. But I needed to find a way to cope with that because that's not going away. Like, I can't wish it away. And sometimes the end of wintering is just acceptance rather than a win. And that, unfortunately, is not terribly fair, but it is again, human.
Oh, that's so lovely. We always say at the end of our podcast when we're trying to solve a dilemma that we solved it. That's a solve right there. I feel like this whole book is a solve, friends. You got to read this book. Amy and I have been texting all week different parts of it. I mean, we read a lot of books for this podcast and we don't often get ourselves quite this excited.
Oh, bless you. That's so lovely.
Catherine, tell us where on the internet we can find you. I know you have a podcast as well.
Yeah, I have a podcast called The Wintering Sessions, where I interview different writers about wintering times in their life. I'm just recording the second series, actually. So I've been doing some really great interviews. I'm so excited to share that. So you can find that wherever you get your podcast. I'm on Instagram. I'm CatherineMay_. And I'm on Twitter. Well, I've got a really complicated Twitter handle. I regret it every time I have to say
it
out loud.
We'll link to it on the show page.
Yeah, please do, because it just sounds silly when you say it out loud, but when you look at it, it looks okay. But Google me, I'm there.
Catherine May's new book is called Wintering: The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. This is a beautiful book for you, for anyone. It's a terrific book. Thank you for talking to us, Catherine.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
Margaret, it's an exciting news day.
An exciting news day indeed, Amy.
A few years ago, we launched our first spinoff podcast, Toddler Purgatory, hosted by the hilarious Blair Brooks and Molly Lloyd.
And guess what? Now Blair and Molly are back with their all-new podcast, Unsticking It.
You know Blair and Molly as two busy moms and actors. And somewhere between potty training and the pandemic, they both felt like they lost their creative kaboom.
In their new podcast, Unsticking It, they are going to talk about how all of us can get back to what lights us up after motherhood. Amy, I need this.
Me too. And Blair and Molly will be talking to fellow imaginative minds. We're talking actors, artists, and creators of all kinds about how we can all unstick ourselves from whatever muck we're stuck in.
Follow, subscribe, and listen to Unsticking It wherever you get your podcasts.
That's Unsticking It with Blair and Molly, because sometimes life sucks.